And there came a point where I said, there is nothing that I can do apart from pray. And I remember, again in slow motion, just praying to a higher power and saying, this is out of my hands. I need you to ensure that I don't crash.
Welcome to the Inner Instinct Podcast, Om. How are you doing today?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great. I'm feeling like I'm healing, and I've just come out of a very restful yoga nidra. So yeah, this is brilliant.
Amazing. I love yoga nidra. It's so good.
Oh, yoga nidra is the best. And I am sure you're aware, I've recently fractured my ankle, so it's forced me to slow down a bit. And so yoga nidra in the middle of the day is not something I would ordinarily do. But now that I'm forced to take it slow and rest, I'm loving it.
Nice. That's good to hear. So we kind of start in a way that you were going anyway, which is great. We're aligned from the get-go, which is to have a bit of an instinctual check-in and a really allowing ourselves to go deep and maybe closing our eyes to do that, to figure out how is Om feeling today in this present moment?
I think if I were to put it in one word, it would be grateful. I'm very grateful for all of the things that are aligning in order for me to physically heal, but also in the rest of my time to have a little bit of time to recalibrate. It's been a busy couple of years coming out of COVID, and I've been very busy with work, and I've also taken on some wonderful service to the community, but the two of those just keep me very busy. And having some downtime to just go deep in my own spiritual practice and check in with myself has just been brilliant. So I start today feeling really grateful for the day and all of the facilities that I have.
That's really nice. Really, really nice to hear. And you said a little bit about your work there, that you do have a full-time job that is a very high demand, fast-paced job in the corporate world. And we did an Instagram live together, so some people who are listening might have seen that. If you haven't, make sure you go and check it out, because we talk a lot about that. How do you balance spirituality also with working full-time in corporate? And you have a lot that you give to the community. So do you want to do a little bit of an introduction as to who you are and what fills your cup and what you get up to?
Sure. So I'll start with work. So my name is Om Dhumatkar. I head up strategy for one of the largest commercial banks in the country. So in the UK, we bank about 20% of all businesses. And that could be, you know, a one-man band window cleaner in Yorkshire, right up to, you know, a £100 million agency in the West End in London. So it's a wide range of businesses. And I love doing that, because it helps make a real impact to people's lives. I think the economy, as it has been globally, and particularly in this country, means that everyone needs to work that much harder to keep businesses going, to keep people in jobs, to, you know, continue to have food on the table. And I think it gives me a huge amount of purpose to be able to do that in a really meaningful sense. I've been doing that for a good 15 years now. I've been in London for about 18 years. So, you know, straight after university, started working and have been at it for a while. Outside of work, I also do a lot of what's known as seva, which is Hindu concept of service. So there's a ton of seva that I like to do on the theme of re-educating and reorienting Hindus towards their faith and philosophical background. And I do that by bringing to life the various Hindu scriptures that we have. I've been doing that on a call for a small group of business leaders in India and over here since about 2021. But earlier this year in 2023, I launched a YouTube channel that just picks the individual themes in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, and explains it for a modern audience. So that's been fun. First time in front of a camera. It's going well so far. It keeps me busy. And between work and my seva, it keeps me grounded.
I love that. And I really love the videos that you do. And a lot of people who follow me on Instagram know that I talk about this a lot, the importance of yoga philosophy, but how challenging it can feel for complete beginners. And even for people who are a bit more new to yoga, because of how it's represented in the West, which is predominantly the poses, maybe a little bit of meditation and breath work rising in popularity now. But the beauty of philosophy has never really been shown in a yoga class in the gym. And I think that's why voices like yours are so important, because we need to be sharing these incredible scriptures. And when you look back and you see the knowledge that they had, thousands of years old, centuries old knowledge that you can apply in your life today, it's really astounding. It's not this old thing. It's very much to be applied in your modern life. And that's why I think that yoga philosophy is, to be honest, it's being a little bit slept on. You know, people are kind of not realizing how cool and how important it is and how impactful it is on their life.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the big challenges that we have when we talk about yoga philosophy or Hindu philosophy or any of these Eastern religious philosophies is that we come up against a barrier called religion in people's minds. And I think that there's a fundamental difference between Eastern and Western religion. I think in the West, the religion is very heavily based on articles of faith. So you have to buy into a premise before you can walk through the door and get the benefit of, you know, a specific religious tradition. And that's not a bad thing, but it's just a barrier to entry. Whereas when we think about Eastern religions, the fundamental way in which each Eastern religion will describe themselves is as a dharma. So as something that is relevant to people's lives, that can wrap itself in and around people's lifestyles. And that's why we have really strong and impactful philosophies like yoga, which is not just about the physical practice, but yes, it says that, you know, we need our bodies to be in a certain shape to be able to execute our lives well. And whilst we're doing that, here's a higher perspective that we can keep in mind so that we do what we need to do, but also evolve spiritually along the way.
I feel like we could talk about yoga and philosophy and everything for such a long time. But obviously the intention for this podcast is, it's called The Inner Instinct. So the idea is that you are sharing your three moments of instinct in your life, three defining moments where you've noticed your instinct come up. And then what's happened, whether you have listened to that instinct, and what's happened if you haven't listened to it. And ultimately, this comes down to self-awareness and greater self-realization. So it is very linked to yoga, but I would love to start off with the first of your instincts. And this takes us back to when you were a child in India. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it's a bit of a hair-raising story. And I think even now when I think back to it, it seems quite unbelievable, but it happened and it's something that I've experienced. So as you can probably tell by my accent, I didn't grow up here in the UK. I grew up in Mumbai in India. And for anyone who's been to Mumbai, you'll know that it's an island and a very popular city, which means that most people live in apartment buildings rather than houses as they do here in London. And one of the relatively unique things about living or growing up in an apartment building was that there were lots of kids my age who were always around to play with. We would quite often as children cycle, and we didn't have anywhere to cycle to because it wasn't safe to be on the road. So, you know, as 8, 9, 10 year olds, we just sort of cycle around the apartment building and just take, you know, fun loops. Now, one of the things that we did when we got a little bit bored cycling was we'd race each other. And the way we'd race each other, because there wasn't any clear track, is we'd sort of go individually, and whoever wasn't cycling would be hanging around doing a bit of a countdown. And so one of these days, like, you know, hundreds of others in the evening after school, having finished all of our homework, there were a few of us cycling, and it was my turn to race. And so my friends were off doing their countdown on the side, and I was cycling as fast as I could. And I come round this corner, and suddenly I see about 100 or so meters away, there's 3 or 4 toddlers playing around with their mums. And I'm, you know, coming down at full speed, as fast as my 10-year-old legs would be able to carry me through a corner. They clearly would have had no idea that I am here to win a speed record in our little group of 10-year-olds. And I would have had no idea that they were there because, you know, these weren't people whom I had seen before. I still remember this moment play out in slow motion where I'm trying to calculate in my head whether I should stop, how I can stop, how I can pull the brake, how can I avoid hitting these kids. Meanwhile, the cycle's getting closer and closer and closer. 100 meters, it's 50 meters, it's 25 meters. And there came a point where I said, there is nothing that I can do apart from pray. And I remember, again in slow motion, just praying to a higher power and saying, this is out of my hands. I need you to ensure that I don't hit anyone. And I remember as we got closer and closer, the moms and their kids registered I was coming. And it was almost like a two-step maneuver where turn left, avoid one, and then turn right in quick succession and avoid another. And just sort of, you know, speed on, as they say. And I think for me, this is something that happened obviously decades ago now, but it's something that sort of really sits as a real memory because it taught me at such a young age that when everything is out of control, there's a higher power that we can rely on to, in this case, literally take the steering wheel and avoid a crash. And it's guided so many things that I've done subsequently, you know, packing bags and coming to this country, for example. I'd never been to London before, but that fear of what might happen was mitigated by the fact that I could rely on something higher to guide me through the vicissitudes. Similar with starting, you know, a YouTube channel, which is not what many managing directors in banking do, but I decided, well, hey ho, let's sort of get public and let's share and let's serve. And I knew that there, if for whatever reason something went wrong, there's a safety net that's going to catch me.
When you were telling that story, I can see you've really gone back into that moment of exactly what was happening within your physical body and in your mind. It's clearly then had an impact on how you've lived your life in the future as well. Do you feel like it deepened your belief and your faith?
So I'm a person of faith. I was born Hindu. I've been a person of faith all of my life, and I would already have been one at that stage. I think what it did was it gave me a practical demonstration of the mystical dimension of Hinduism, which sometimes is very hard to encounter unless we've done a certain amount of meditative practice or yoga or what we call sadhana. And here I was just a 10-year-old with, you know, everything to lose and no control of the situation, relying on something higher. I still see it as a very mystical experience. And you're right, like I went back to the moment. I can remember what time of day it was. I can remember where the sun was in its, you know, in its journey into the Arabian Ocean as it set in the evening. I can remember the sea breeze. I can remember the sound of coconut leaves rustling and just this entire moment play out in slow motion.
When you were changing direction, did you feel that you were in control of that moment, or did you feel that something had kind of taken over?
100% I felt that something had taken over. And I don't mean this as a woo-woo scenario, you know, that there was sort of some ghost in the sky that took control of my bike and navigated me. I feel like in our lives, we have the ability to navigate as appropriately as possible. But sometimes, despite our best intentions, we end up in scenarios that we simply can't control. And I think in those scenarios, the reality is that there is a lot of noise in our heads that inhibits our ability to navigate the situation in the most appropriate way. And I think if we are able to shut those noises off, we find that there's an inner voice that can navigate us as appropriately as possible. You know, even in my study of the Bhagavad Gita, it says that, you know, here's some ways that you can do it. Here's some techniques, methodologies. It talks about surrender. It talks about recognition of a higher power. But obviously, as a 12-year-old, in a moment where not only are you going to crash, and crashing wasn't necessarily as much of a concern because I had permanent scrapes on my knees and elbows, but it was the potential to hurt someone else, hurt someone who was, you know, defenseless in that situation. That's what really scared me. And I said, look, I have no control. And I saw that there was, I call it a higher power because it was beyond my immediate capability in the moment. But I also recognized that that came from somewhere deep within me, where the voice of Om, the noise in Om's head shut down, and that inner capability just took over and helped me maneuver through that situation.
That's such an incredible story. But it's funny, because I know you said that you're not trying to be like woo-woo and kind of too spiritual when you say something took over. But I think the whole idea behind these conversations is that sometimes we just can't explain things. And there are these mystical things that happen in many of our lives. And actually to honor whatever that is, as opposed to think, oh no, that's just silly, and kind of throw it to one side. Because often then we do that with our instinct, because we can't put any rationale behind that's the reason why you're feeling you should do that instead of doing this. If you can't put a scientific reasoning behind it, you're less likely to go with it. But that's what the gut instinct is. And it's this deep knowing or this kind of mystical understanding that you can't quite explain, but we're so used to, with Western mindsets, having to have a breakdown and fully be able to explain everything and have the data. And if we don't have the data before making the decision, we can't make the decision. And actually, it's trusting and allowing ourselves to sit with those experiences that we can't always explain and see what happens.
Well, look, I completely agree with you. And I think that there's definitely a space, a very important space for, you know, maintaining our rational mind and ensuring that we don't let go of our critical thinking. But at its heart, we have to recognize that all of our lives have meaning and purpose. And meaning and purpose are not the same thing. Meaning is something that's inherent. Purpose can be the mechanism through which we will bring that meaning to life. And ordinarily, we call that purpose as karma. That's at least how it manifests. And so instinct is just that voice that nudges us towards our purpose. And our purpose isn't necessarily meta grand narratives that help change the world, but they're little baby steps that we take to get to the point that we can impact both ourselves and others positively. So that's certainly how instinct played out in this scenario, and has played out separately as well, where it was the recognition that nothing would be served by, you know, crashing into these defenseless little children. I'd probably end up with a broken bone, something that's happened, you know, many years subsequent, and is very much a living reality at the moment. But yeah, no purpose would have been served from that crash, which is why the instinct kicked in.
Incredible. Let's talk about the next time you had a moment of instinct that clearly has defined your life, because it's one of the three that you picked. And this is a quite a different scenario in an interview with a big company, I think in London, if I'm right.
That's right, yeah. So this was about 15 years ago now. I graduated from university in the throes of the global financial crisis in 2008, which was great fun. And I don't mean that ironically, it genuinely was good fun to sort of see how the cookie crumbled in some respects. And because I was just a graduate at that stage and I had nothing to lose, I was able to sort of keep an element of sort of academic observership in place. And I think, of course, I just didn't know how bad it was. You know, I hadn't lived enough of life to realize that you could lose everything in that scenario. So it was a bit of a roller coaster ride. But as it happened, I ended up losing my first job and I started the entire sort of graduate milk round process all over again. I was interviewing at a top tier management consultancy here in London. As I walked in about 20 minutes or so early, because I just didn't want to be late. As I walked in about 20 minutes early, I met someone in the waiting area whose interviews had finished 20 minutes late. So he had just finished his round of interviews and he was waiting in the waiting area to sort of, you know, return his badge and be allowed to leave. And I was there early with my sort of badge, sitting down and wondering what the next 2 or 3 hours might look like. And, you know, as it happens, we get talking. He says, okay, well, which part of consulting are you applying for? Because this was a big company and they used to consult, you know, strategy, people, HR stuff. They would consult for technology. But as it happens, both of us were applying for strategy. And he said to me, you know, they've allocated all of the strategy roles, right? I said, oh, well, I had no idea. He's like, yeah. all of the strategy roles have been allocated to people who've interned in the company already, which means that, you know, all of the roles that are left are this sort of adjacent bit of strategy. So if they ask you if you're okay with the role for that, just say yes. Now, let's sort of recap this scenario. Here's someone who is competing with me for a role in one of the most prestigious companies here in London, at one of the most difficult times to be able to find a job, and literally giving me advice on what I should say in a given scenario. So obviously, you know, you're 21 and sometimes instinct kicks in and says, right, trust this person. And so it so happened that I was asked that exact question and said, look, all of the strategy roles have been allocated, but we've got this sort of adjunct role that's available. Would you be open to it? And ordinarily, I would have said, no way, you know, I've got all of these other strategy roles lined up. I'd rather go there and not do this. But in the moment, I found myself saying, yeah, that's fine. I'd love to do that. And as it happened, I got the job. My friend got the job. And we're friends to this date. I was at his wedding a few years ago, and I know his little son pretty well now. And it actually set me on a very different career path than I might have imagined, because I think one of the challenges of strategy as a business function is it tends to be quite abstract. It tends to be very much, you know, along the lines of, you know, company A wants to buy company B. What should the price of the deal be, and how should they make it profitable in 5 years from now? It's a very abstract thing where you do a little bit of analysis and you share your presentation and your findings and leave. Whereas what I ended up doing was doing a lot of very real work that said, if a company was going to let go of, you know, 500 people, surely they would need to have some sort of organized operation to be able to deal with the customers that have been left behind. So how many of those 500 people that are being let go of could we accommodate, and how can we make sure that it's as seamless a journey for customers? Today, how that plays out is every time I'm sort of on the block for a multi-million pound decision in the bank, or at least a recommendation, if not a decision, I've got a very real idea of what it means to be a colleague in that scenario facing into customers. I've got a very real idea of what it means to be a customer in that scenario being impacted by, you know, n number of different scenarios as we're now experiencing business challenges, high rates of failure, very high rates of inflation. And as we were seeing about 2 years ago, you know, uncertainty about society opening up the way we've known it. And I think having that empathy has not just made me a better professional and hasn't just made me more successful to be able to navigate my career potentially faster than I otherwise would have. I feel like it's also made me a better person, because it's kept the humanity of the corporate world alive for me, which, as I'm sure you've experienced and I've certainly sort of seen from time to time, when you're in glass buildings, air-conditioned 100, 200 feet above the road level, you tend to lose perspective. And being able to keep that perspective is a gift. And it's something that happened as a result of a chance encounter 15 years ago in an interview waiting room with a graduate who was competing with me for the job.
What I find so interesting is that everything that we know in society would tell you to not listen to the person who's going up against you for this job. But somehow your instinct kicked in and said, no, listen to this person.
Absolutely. And I think it was just how disarmingly he was willing to help me. I think that's what really gave me my confirmation in the moment. Because here was someone who wasn't sizing me up, who wasn't trying to sabotage me, who wasn't sort of worried about his prospects. He was someone who was very comfortable in his own skin, and very, you know, seemingly clear on what the outcome would be for him. And so was willing to share his insight with some guy who had shown up 20 minutes early for the next round of interviews. So it's both the complete randomness of the scenario that I'm 20 minutes early, he's 20 minutes late, we're in the room together, and he decides to be open and helpful. And boom, you know, we took the advice and here we are.
I think it's a lesson as well. 93% of how we communicate with people is nonverbal, and 7% is what we say, so verbal. And in this situation, you're reading the 93% of the way that what he's saying is coming across in order, and maybe that's where your instinct gets that courage to say, no, listen to this person, because you're looking at tone and you're looking at body language and you're looking at how they hold themselves and all their different facial expressions to be able to see, do I want to believe this person? Do I want to trust them? Or is it something to watch out for? And I guess within ourselves, when our instinct kicks in, it's about keeping us safe or watching whether there's a threat. And so that 93% of nonverbal obviously allowed your instinct to think, this isn't a threat, this is something I should be listening to and following.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a role that meditation played, because meditation is a practice that I'd started whilst I was at university. So at that stage, when, you know, this situation happened, I would have been practicing it for at least 2 years at that point. And I think one of the things that meditation does is it strips away a lot of the noise in our head and allows us to see the situation and people as they actually are. And I think there was something that, as a result of not having this sort of very calculative voice in my head that said, oh, you know, what's this person's intention and what's sort of, where are they coming from? And, you know, come on, you've got other jobs lined up or other interviews lined up. Why do you want to go for this one? It just said, trust him. And as a result of trusting him, everything's worked out.
Being able to tune into that self-awareness piece.
Absolutely. Again, I keep saying this both in this conversation as well as in life, that, you know, our inner instinct isn't a woo-woo thing. So we have this voice inside of us. We have this guide inside of us. We tune it out with our own likes and dislikes and preferences and instincts that may have been honed over years and years. But we've got this sort of inner guide that's just there and that's quietly nudging us and guiding us forward. And we've just got to get ourselves to a position where we can listen.
And listen even when everything else is telling you that the easier thing would be to not listen to it. The third and final instinct of yours is a huge, huge decision to make. It's not something that you would make lightly. And funnily enough, it's actually something that I was speaking about with one of our other podcast guests. I mean, I'll let you share it, but it started with a question, just one question that your friend asked you, and kind of the ripple effect that that then created, obviously was bubbling away within you anyway, but the ripple effect that that one person asked you and then where we're at now.
Yeah, so I mean, this is, you know, absolutely hot off the press. It's not even 6 months old. So I have a small group that I teach the Bhagavad Gita to every week. And we've been doing that since the summer of 2021. We get together on a Zoom call every Sunday. There's people all over the world, but it just so happened that in December of this year, we were all in India at the same time. And so we decided to spend some time in a monastery, just, you know, spend some time together and enjoy the facilities. And by facilities, I don't mean, you know, the living facilities, but more having the facility of wise people who are living a spiritual path around us and use that as an opportunity to recalibrate at the end of the year and prepare for the next. So we were all in this monastery, and one of the attendees for that weekly class turned around and said, so do you think you would do this full time? Do you think you'd come back to India and do it? The answer to doing it full time was no. And coming back to India was double no. There's no way I'm, you know. I love serving and I love speaking about the Bhagavad Gita. I love making it real and sharing my own insights and how it's impacted me. But having that as something I do full time whilst putting, you know, my career in inverted commas on pause was just something I hadn't contemplated. At that time, I obviously started filming for my YouTube channel on the Bhagavad Gita. And, you know, those videos were in production and all of those good things. So there was obviously a wider avenue for service that was that had opened up and that was ready to grow. But that, you know, was always as an addendum to my day job rather than something that occupied the entirety of my attention. And as the trip evolved, more and more things started to nudge me towards considering this service for at least for a period of time as something that I do full time. After this, you know, small trip to the monastery, I was traveling through southern India and ended up in Kerala, which, you know, you might know, some of the listeners might know, is a stunningly beautiful state on the southwestern coast of India. And because it's on the coast and it gets, you know, all of the sort of bounty of the monsoons, there's coconut palms and greens everywhere and, you know, water bodies. And it's always been quite a prosperous part of the country, not just today, but, you know, for hundreds of years. And Hindu society as it is has emphasized quite heavily on service via faith over the years. So what that means is, you know, wealthy communities would support local teachers, local monasteries. And so what we have is teaching institutes that are hundreds of years old. And I found myself at the home, at the birthplace of Adi Shankaracharya, who is an absolute guiding light in Hinduism, and lived in 800 BC. I was born, you know, 1200 years ago, and his ancestral home 1200 years ago is still intact and in good shape, might I say. So I found myself at that home with the intention of, you know, paying my respects to Adi Shankaracharya and exploring the institute that has been built around it. And whilst I'm there, you know, I'm sort of in his birthroom alone, which is an incredible meditative space, but it's not, you know, there's no frills, as it were. There's no barrier between the deity and us as the practitioner. It's just something that you can have quite close contact with. And so I'm sat there and I've meditated a little bit and I come out of my meditation and I just say in my heart, you, as Adi Shankaracharya, have paved an incredible road for anyone who has taught Hinduism after you. I am, you know, if he was a mighty gushing river, I am like a little monsoon stream that's contributing to that work. But I asked for guidance and support. And I said that, look, you know, I'm walking in your footsteps. I'm doing what I can in a very small way. I'm sharing my own experience. But just please guide me, you know, be with me as this process evolves. And I was saying that prayer. I come out of the room. One of the resident teachers at this institute that still continues 1,200 years later, and whom I've been in touch with for several months, trying to nudge them to release a certain course that they teach, which is relatively rare and hasn't been taught for a few years because there just haven't been enough students. As I come out of the room, he meets me and he says, "Oh, you know what? That course that you were asking me about, yeah, we're going to teach that course this year." Which absolutely blew my mind because it's been something I've been wanting to learn. And I think it's something that's quite rare in today's world to have explained to you, you know, in a very systematized way. I feel like we rely very heavily on e-learning and self-learning and all of that. And in India, we have this concept of a gurukul where you're a resident at the teacher's home. And you know, there's very intense day-to-day in-person teaching and individual contemplation and practice time. So to be able to have the scriptures taught in that environment is a very, very rare opportunity indeed. And I knew immediately that, okay, well, I have to take advantage of it because I don't know when it's going to come again. I know that it's going to be a couple of months long, which means that, you know, I don't have enough annual leave to be able to take it, which means that I'm going to have to take an unpaid sabbatical. And as the rules of sabbaticals go, you're only allowed to take one every few years. And I haven't taken one ever in my career. So I said, well, if I'm doing one for 2 months, might as well do one for 12 months. And so, you know, within about, not even 10 days, within about like a week of being asked the question, would you take a break from work and teach full time? Where my answer was emphatically no. Suddenly I find myself contemplating 12 months off of work, being able to teach full time, but also be a student full time. And here we are, now it's happening. I've got a sabbatical booked in from work. I'm going to be away in India, in Southern India. I'm going to be teaching, I'm going to be serving. And, you know, it goes back to the theme of this podcast, which is how do we navigate our lives? And I think the first 3 years of my life in London, which was at university, helped build the foundation, not just academically, not just professionally, but spiritually as well, for the subsequent 15 years that have followed. And the subsequent 15 years, including the period that we were all affected by COVID, have been very productive. They've been very productive, not just for the organizations that I've worked for, but for me individually. You know, and I'm very privileged that I'm at this point where, you know, I the home over my head is secure. And, you know, I've got an emergency stash of cash if anything goes wrong in life. And actually, I have the massive privilege of being able to afford hiring someone to film me and someone else to edit it and get it on YouTube. You know, to be able to serve is a privilege. So those 3 years set me up for these 15 years that are now coming to an end. We've all got, you know, at least sort of 30 to 40 years of productive lifetime left from our mid-30s onwards. So for me, these next 12 months are all about building the foundation for those next 30 to 40 years. And it might be that I take the experience and come back to London and continue my professional life in banking as it was. It might mean that I stop completely and explore something completely different to what I was doing right now. But I know that rather than a moment of instinct that has passed and I can see its results, this one is very much a moment of instinct that's live. And there's uncertainty, but it's also quite exciting uncertainty because it's got everything that the previous moments of instinct have given me, which is a safety net to fall into and clarity that, you know, you can have 15 years of an awesome life built off of a very chance bit of guidance that you see in an interview room. So, yeah, it's extremely, extremely interesting and exciting.
I think sometimes friends see stuff before the individual does. And that's why I think friends who ask questions like that and can be open and actually push you a little bit are really great to have around you, because you want to be surrounded by people who are like, check yourself, what's going on? What do you, you know, what do you want to do in your life? Or would you consider doing this? Because it almost ignites a spark, which is that instinct really, that has been in you for quite some time, but has maybe been laying dormant because of all the thought patterns we have. And like you said, you've been doing what you've been doing successfully for the last 15 years. Why change that? But actually having a friend ask a question and then things progressing created more of a realization of, yeah, okay, actually let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yoga philosophy speaks of a higher reality all the time. And different schools of philosophy see that higher reality in different ways. Some schools see it as something that's sort of quite universal. Some see it as something that's absolutely deep within us, in our hearts, in our soul, as it were. And some see it as a separate sort of external reality that in the Western world we might call God. But all three of these variations are difficult to communicate with where we are. So, you know, how can we say that the universe speaks to us? I think the universe speaks to us through the scenarios and people that we surround ourselves with. And I think here it was a very clear indication of something, you know, mystical wrapped up in a very innocuous question. And that's why I think it's so beautiful.
Yeah, I love that so much. That's so great. Well, we are towards the end of our episode. So to wrap up, we like to end the podcast in the same way that we started. You were feeling grateful at the start, which is a beautiful place to start from. So we close off with another instinctual check-in on how you're doing right now.
I think I'm doing well. No, I think I know that I'm doing great. And I know what needs to happen, not in terms of the external seva that I'm doing, but in terms of the internal attitude that I need to adopt as I go. And I think there's going to be an element of gaining for sure, but in order to gain, we need to shed. And I think, you know, I'm very clearly looking at a scenario where I shed any notions of who I was in banking or what I've been able to achieve. I shed the idea that I'm in control and working towards specific outcomes. Ultimately, it would be shedding this notion of I, which, you know, typically we call as our ego, which is scary in one respect, but it's also hugely exciting in another. Because, you know, if we've always been carrying around in a pair of shoes that are even half a size too small, getting the right size of shoes seems like quite an exciting prospect. And in yogic philosophy and in, you know, wider Hindu philosophy, in the Bhagavad Gita as well, we are told that our identity truly is expansive and is touched by the divine. And so to have a scenario where I can be supported as I step out of this identity that's been built up over the last 30 something years, and certainly built up over the last 15 years professionally, and step into something where I don't know where it'll end up, but is going to be expansive, is a really wonderful feeling. So yeah, I'm feeling really excited about that.
I really hope people who listen to that feel into that for themselves, because so many of us think we have to stick to that one career that we said, you know, when we were younger and asked, what do you want to do when you grow up? This was it, and now we're doing it, and we feel almost super glued to that. And there comes a lot of attachment, and like you were mentioning, the ego is there as well, in terms of attachment to a particular title, attachment to a particular amount of money you're making every year or every month. And actually, there's so much bravery in being able to detach from that and open yourself up to go down a different path, which you've described really beautifully. So I hope people feel inspired that they too can go down that route, or at least start unpicking some of those thought patterns that are ingrained within us because of what we've put on ourselves, but also from a societal perspective, so that you can free yourself and get to that moksha, that liberation, and find whatever that might be for you. Thank you so much for joining us. It was so good to speak, as always. I know it feels like we could speak for hours and hours on end. So I really appreciate your time. And we will be leaving all of Om's details, links to where you can find his work, in the show notes. So make sure that you check that out and give him a listen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be able to connect with your community. And I wish both you and all of your listeners the very best.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, share it with someone that you know, hit subscribe, and follow us for more conversations on instinct, energy, and life-changing moments. See you soon.